We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. When Barack Obama was running for president, his family in his early years got extensive coverage in the media. At the same time, says our guest for the show, journalist Jenny Scott, the stories in the media about the president's mother were limited and really not entirely accurate. Our guest says that Barack Obama's mother, Ann Dunham, was a woman who was full of contradictions, but remarkably resilient. She was someone who took big risks. She crossed deep racial and cultural divides. And she says it's impossible to think about her without thinking about the influence that she had on her son. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Jenny Scott about her new, recently published biography of Ann Dunham. The title of the book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother, and Riverhead Books is the publisher. It's just out. So if you'd like to read the book, you can seek it out in the library or bookstore. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, Jenny Scott. She's been a newspaper reporter for more than 30 years, most recently at the New York Times. Back in 2007, early 2008, as part of the paper's coverage of the presidential campaign, she wrote a number of biographical articles about Barack Obama. And an article that she wrote about his mother, which appeared in the paper in 2008, really ended up leading to her writing this book, spending considerable amount of time, additional time, at writing this book, Singular Woman. She's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free. So if it would be long-distance call, use that. You can also use our email if you'd like to send in your question that way. The address is will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. We certainly welcome calls. We hope people will be brief and will be on target with the topic, but otherwise your involvement in the conversation is certainly welcome. And Ms. Scott, hello.
Hi, David. Good morning.
Well, good morning, and thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. Thank you.
Well, you know, in writing and talking about his childhood, the president, Mr. Obama, has certainly had a lot to say about his father. In fact, he wrote a memoir that was titled Dreams from My Father. Well, and I know this interview is not really about Barack Obama, but in the course of doing the book on his mom, you did talk with the president, and I'm just curious about what he has to say about having spent a lot of time talking about this man that he barely knew, and it seems so little talking about this woman that he also has said was the single constant in his life.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. He, as you know, the book was his memoir, which did focus on his father, was published in 1995, just as he was beginning to go into public life and run for his first elective office. And his mother died just a few months after that. And then in 2004, the book was a new edition was published after he spoke at the Democratic Convention in Boston. And in that, he wrote a new preface saying, had he known that she was going to die, he might have written a different book, less a rumination on the absent father and more focused on his mother, the single constant in his life. Then 2 years after that, he came back in The Audacity of Hope and wrote about her more extensively and in ways that he had not written about her before, talking about her profound influence that she had on him in terms of his decision to go into public service and the way she impressed upon him her values, which are really the values that we've seen enunciated over and over again in his political campaigns. So it's almost as though when he was younger and sorting out his racial identity, which the book originally rose out of that period when he'd been first elected as the first black president of the Harvard Law Review, he was focused on his finding his place as an African American. And his mother, her story was sort of put to the side during that period, I would say, and oversimplified both by perhaps by him, but particularly by the way it's been covered in the press. Mm-hmm. So what I really wanted to do was mainly because her story is so extraordinarily unusual and so unorthodox for Americans, for women, just so different, that I wanted to explore what that story was and just put it out there, because I do think not only is it a great tale about a single parent, a woman, an American, a mother, but I also think it reflects on the president in ways that enable us to see him in see more dimensions in him.
Yeah. It just, I think the word that often comes up in describing her, if one is looking for a single word, one of the words that's often used is unconventional. You just use the word unorthodox. You know, it's difficult to describe someone just in one word, but certainly it is true if you look at the choices that she made in her life, she certainly was unconventional. And because, you know, I think also it's interesting, as you say, a lot of people seem to associate her with the counterculture and think that she was kind of a hippie. But the fact of the matter is that she really predates the counterculture. So it might not have been so unusual if we were talking about the mid to late 1960s, but we're not. We're talking about a period really before that.
You're right. She came of age, you know, she turned 18 in 1960. So her teenage years were spent in the late 50s in outside Seattle. There's two mistakes there, I think, in people's conception of that. One, like you say, she antedates that period. And secondly, there's really nothing hippie about her. While she did go and live in a country where batik is popular, and you know, an expression of cultural and a form of cultural expression there, and she did have long hair, she was a hard-driving professional for much of her life. She was, as one of her bosses told me, she was as type A as any of us. Here's a person who, when you get to the question of unconventional choices, you know, who at 17, at a time when nearly two dozen American states had laws against interracial marriage, she conceived a child with an African, married him, the marriage ended, and then shortly after that married an Indonesian, and in her early 20s took her six-year-old half-African son to Indonesia to join her husband at a time when there had been enormous political and social upheaval in that country, and hundreds of thousands of Indonesians are thought to have been killed during that period. But then after that, she went back to graduate school, became an anthropologist, did very respected field work in small villages in Java while raising two children, went on to work for the Ford Foundation, held multiple jobs in international development, and then in the late 80s became a key figure in what was at that time the largest microfinance program, commercial microfinance program in the world, doing small lending to poor families, business people, women in all over Indonesia. So she had a very demanding career in male-dominated fields, and at the same time was a single parent, supporting two children, and also trying to complete her education through this whole thing. So there's really nothing, when you look at the details, nothing terribly hippie-ish about her.
Yeah. Well, now you just there did a wonderful job of giving the thumbnail sketch of her life in like a paragraph or two, but it just makes your head spin, really, when you think about everything that she, the things that she did in her life, all these remarkable experiences and turning points and unconventional choices they made, and then you think about the fact that she, sadly enough, she died really rather young. She was only 52 when she died. That's a lot to pack into a relatively short period of time.
Yes, it really is.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Jenny Scott. She is a former reporter for the New York Times and is author of a new book, A Singular Woman. It's a biography of Ann Dunham, Barack Obama's mother, and it's published by Riverhead. Questions welcome again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, certainly, you know, one of the things I'm sure we'll talk about is what one can say about perhaps the kind of influence that she had on her son, this man who went on to become president of the United States. You also have to ask this question: well, what were the important things that formed her character, and maybe were there some things particularly about her upbringing or her parents that set the stage for then the person that she was going to become?
Well, she was born in 1942, during wartime in Wichita, Kansas. Her father was in the military. And when her father got out of the military, they quickly left Kansas, moved out to California so that he could go to college. He dropped out of college. They returned to Kansas, moved to Oklahoma, moved to Texas, moved back to Kansas, then went out to Seattle. So one of the characteristics of her childhood was constant motion, certainly for the first 13 years. Her parents, we would imagine, people often say, well, how did a woman like that come from a couple from small-town Kansas? But her parents, I found, were not what the stereotype would suggest. They were They had an unconventional streak themselves. They came from families that valued education enormously. Going way back, there were teachers and educators among their forebears. In one branch of the family, every son was being offered the chance to go to college as early as the Oklahoma Territory. So in some ways, I sometimes think her side of the family is as educated as the forebears of any American president. I'm just sort of guessing at that, but it's really striking, particularly in her parents' generation. All of their siblings went to college. Three of the four of them went to graduate school. Two ended up with PhDs. That really mattered. So her childhood, there was a lot of movement, and her parents cared a lot about her education, even though they hadn't completed college themselves. So I would say that those things. Now, obviously, there's an underlying temperament issue too. She was very bright from a young age. An uncle of hers, who is an educational person, worked in education, did a intelligence test on her when she was. He happened to be living with them when she was three or four, and he told me rather proudly that it was very impressive. But she had an interesting sort of wry sense of humor from a pretty young age. She was quite capable of laughing at herself. In a way, she had a sort of outsider's sensibility, partly because of this constant motion and perhaps just a temperament issue and perhaps intelligence. She didn't feel the need to conform necessarily to every single place that she landed, because the way she, you know, moved all the time. Mm-hmm. She also didn't have a lot of friends until high school. She had, because she was in constant motion. In high school, she formed a number of friendships with people who were quite like her, sort of interesting kind of cultural critics, in a way, of the high school scene, people who were sort of insiders. They weren't part of the central group, but they tended to be very good in school, and they did a lot of reading, and so sort of an intellectual crowd. And I think all of those influences you really see carrying on in the rest of her life. It's fascinating that she chose to become an anthropologist, where the work is, you know, to be the participant observer. In a way, many of her friends described her in high school as the participant observer of their high school culture.
And yet, at the same time, that's, you know, the ideal, I guess, is that you're the participant observer, but you're always also standing back and never really, because you're not ever going to be really part of this group of people that you're observing. You can't be.
Yeah, I think the idea of, as it was explained to me by anthropologists, is that you present yourself in a place that is utterly foreign, and you allow them to socialize you to their world, and you come to understand it from the inside by what they have shown you. But you are, as you say, always the observer also. But a willingness to open yourself to understand that community. Ultimately, that's what her work became, not just in her scholarly work as an anthropologist, but in international development. What her role was to explain to the outside agency, the development agency, the views and values of the community she was trying to help.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, you look at the experiences of people like her who have grown up with families where they're always moving and where they're not in one place for very long. They can adapt two kind of strategies, I suppose, in a sense that a person like that can be the perpetual outsider all their life, or they can be the kind of person that arrives at a new place and instantly finds a way to fit in. And I suppose one, in an odd way, one can actually be both. You can be both of those kinds of things.
Yeah, I think you're right. I talked to people who had raised their children in the same way, because she had knew a lot of people who had international experience. And one of the characteristics they talked about was that it leads to a non-judgmental quality, that you are, there's a kind of openness to the extraordinary variety of people, of values, et cetera, and a willingness to sort of go with whatever someone presents as their, you know, view. So she, I think that's a really striking aspect of her character going through life, is this remarkable intellectual and emotional openness. So while she's an outsider, she's not closed to the appeal of ideas, of cultures, of individuals. She's willing to allow herself to be moved and have her mind changed, and to be brought to think. And you just really see that in some of her choices. You know, her at 17 falling for an African student on a campus in which he was the first African student, then moving to Indonesia and becoming quite captivated by that culture, and so much so that she ended up spending more than half of her adult life there. And some of the people that she met who came from such worlds so far different from her and yet who she was very close to. Her daughter Maya Satoru Eng told me that she thought that one of the foundations of her mother's strength was this kind of openness and willingness to be moved.
Mm. When she met Barack Obama Sr., the Barack's dad, he was 23, she was 17, and I get the feeling that she really had not had a serious... She'd never had a serious boyfriend at that point, and now in her late teens, she meets this African man, she gets pregnant, they get married. Do you have some sort of sense of what it was she was attracted to in Barack Obama Sr.?
Well, yes, you're right that many of the people who knew her in high school said they never knew of her having a boyfriend. And another friend of hers from graduate school, who Anne talked about this with later, said that she was a virgin at the time that she met Barack Obama. She had arrived just weeks before in Hawaii, or certainly on the campus of the University of Hawaii, and was really a fish out of water in many ways. She hadn't wanted to move to Honolulu. Her father, who was a furniture salesman, had moved there for work and had insisted that she come along. He didn't want her staying behind in Seattle and going to the University of Washington, which would have been her choice. So she, you know, you can imagine she was probably a little bit at sea. And Barack Obama Sr. had been there already for a year. He was kind of, apparently, according to people I interviewed who knew him at the university, kind of a big man on campus in some ways. He was extraordinarily charismatic. He was very, very intelligent. He had a fantastic voice that everybody said was his instrument of choice, you know, was one of the sources of his attractiveness. One of his classmates told me that their economics professor, I think it was, would fall silent when Barack Obama spoke. He seemed to have a lot of authority, and he had a slightly British accent that to Americans sounded like, you know, Oxford and Cambridge. And so I think he was a pretty impressive guy, and she was willing to be impressed. And then an uncle of hers, the brother of her father, said to me that her relationship with her father had been somewhat tempestuous, and he was overly protective and controlling. And this uncle, Ralph Dunham, told me that he wondered whether the tensions in that relationship ultimately led Anne to do some of the things that she did. So I think she was naturally attracted to different kinds of people, but also she might have been trying to get away from something that was all too familiar and somewhat claustrophobic to her.
Now, how did her parents feel about her marriage to Barack Obama?
Well, that's a hard thing to nail down because neither of them is alive, and their siblings, they were all living so far apart that and you know, phone calls were more expensive than that. I don't think anyone was really kept apprised. Some of them even learned about this after the fact, like certainly after she'd become pregnant, even sometimes after the marriage, after the marriage had taken place. The president describes this somewhat in his book, Dreams from My Father. I think that her parents, on the one hand, were not thrilled that their daughter at 17 had become pregnant and quickly dropped out of college. This was something that mattered a lot to them. They were probably more open racially than we might imagine Americans from that part of the country in that time in American history would have been. I think they, partly because they'd moved a lot themselves and perhaps because Stanley Dunham himself never felt like he really belonged, he had a kind of sympathy, perhaps, which this is suggested largely by the president, for the problems, for black people and their problems with race in the country, because he felt that he, too, had encountered prejudice of a different sort. On the other hand, they were impressed by Barack Obama Sr. He was an impressive man. And Madeline Dunham, Anne's mother's sister, Arlene, told me that she had spent time with the Dunham family and Barack Obama Sr. in a subsequent period, and that she was struck by how much they not were in awe of him, but they wanted to listen to him. They were interested in what he had to say. You know, so I think their feelings were probably conflicted. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, there's a hint of this in the president's book, they perhaps had a feeling of, we're just going to have to sit tight and see if this will pass, because they knew that their child at that point was a pretty strong-willed person who they were not likely to be able to change her mind once she'd made it up. So I think the complex mix of feelings that many parents might have of, attraction, concern for their daughter, and a sense that they better just keep their mouth shut.
When she was born, they named her Stanley Ann, and she didn't, understandably enough, didn't really care that much for being named Stanley, and later on dropped it, and she just used Ann. And I'm a little fuzzy on this. Do you feel like you understand exactly what the circumstances of her being named Stanley were?
Well, it was a terrible burden to her. She didn't like being called Stanley. She once told her daughter she wished she had been called, back then as a child, wished she'd been called Deborah. The traditional story is that Stanley Dunham, her father, wanted a boy, didn't get a boy, and so slapped his name on his daughter. That was the story she used to jokingly tell when people would interminably ask her, so why are you called Stanley? You can imagine moving like that and meeting people constantly, how hard it would be to have to explain that over and over. So the quip was, my father wanted a boy and he got me. But I found actually that another explanation from people who were close to Anne's mother. Anne's mother had grown up in Augusta, Kansas during the Depression, gone to a lot of movies, and was a great fan of Bette Davis. She, to some extent, styled herself after Bette Davis. And in 1942, when Anne was born, in the summer before Anne was born, Bette Davis came out with a movie directed by John Huston in which she played a character named Stanley Timberlake. And this movie caused quite a stir because it represented apparently a sort of shift in the screen image of Bette Davis. And shortly after Stanley Ann was born and named Stanley Ann, someone asked Madeline, well, why did you pick that name? And she said, well, you know, Bette Davis played a character named Stanley. So I think that may have been as powerful an influence as the fact that her husband's name was Stanley, because most people don't think Stanley Dunham would have been able to prevail upon Madeline to take a name that she didn't want to use.
Well, so she met Barack Obama Sr., she got pregnant, they got married. The marriage ended when she found out that he, in fact, had another wife in Kenya.
The marriage may have ended even before that. I don't know the exact chronology. The fact that he had another wife and was not divorced from this person, that clearly was a factor in it. However, I think I've also understand from friends of hers that once they got married, which was in, I think, was in around February, some months before their son was born, the relationship changed, and she felt that Barack Obama Sr. became took a very different posture toward her. And one scene that was described to me suggested he was, certainly, at least verbally, abusive. This was a scene in which she presented him with some dinner that she'd prepared, and he looked at it and said, you expect me to eat this, and then picked it up and threw it at the wall. This was a story that Anne told to a friend of hers in graduate school. So I think whatever went on in that relationship, and it's very difficult to know because so many of the characters are dead, the people are dead, whatever went on, it happened very fast, the whole thing. Her meeting him, falling in love with him, conceiving the child, and then the marriage ending. Because shortly after the birth of their son, Anne left Seattle with their son. Left Honolulu and moved back to Seattle to try and make a go of it on her own at the University of Washington.
And then ended up going back to Hawaii because her parents were there.
Yes, apparently, according to her friends in Seattle, it seems that she just found it was too tough to be a single mother trying to get her undergraduate degree and on her own. So she went back to Hawaii, and her parents helped her very much with the taking care of her son while she returned to school and got her bachelor's degree in anthropology.
So then it was back in Hawaii then that she met the man who would be her second husband. He was an Indonesian grad student there at the university, and they got married and they moved back to Jakarta, and she took Barack, and he was six at the time. Tell us about her second husband.
Well, Lolo Satoru was his name. He was Javanese. He was one of the first Javanese students to come to the University of Hawaii. This was at a very interesting time in the history of that university. The federal government had funded in 1960, in the wake of Hawaii statehood, an institute of sort of cultural and technical exchange between East and West called the East-West Center, which was then located on the campus of the University of Hawaii, and it brought a whole influx of Asian students to that campus and also sent American students to Asia, and it created a very energetic new focus in that place, even more than had existed in the past, on the outside world, the Pacific, and Asia. And so a lot of the most exciting stuff that was happening in that campus at the time that Anne was there after she returned from Seattle centered around this East-West Center, the students who were there. The apparently the best cafeteria on campus was the one at the East-West Center, because the very much more interesting food and all sorts of great conversation to be had, because the Asian students were strongly encouraged to be constantly talking to the American students. So there was a lot of contact, and she met Lolo Satoru. He was very different from Barack Obama Sr. He was very genial, not as intimidating intellectually. He was funny. He loved to party. He was apparently a very good tennis player. She told her daughter that she admired how he looked in his tennis shorts. He seemed like, in a way, sort of the kind of comfortable alternative to this rather impressive, awesome, somewhat intimidating figure that she'd been married to first. So they did marry very relatively quickly, and then because of the political and social upheaval in Indonesia starting in September 1965, he was summoned back to Indonesia, as all foreign students were, and went back precipitously without Anne and her son, and she then finished off her undergraduate degree and as soon as she could moved in 67 to Jakarta to join him.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus with Janie Scott. She's a former reporter for the New York Times, and we're talking about a new book that she's written. It's a biography of Barack Obama's mother. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Amasong, Champaign-Urbana's premier lesbian feminist chorus, founded by Christina Berger in 1990, will celebrate its 20th anniversary with two concerts this weekend. On the Wednesday edition of Live and Local, I'll talk with Christina about the group as it was then, and we'll hear the group live as it is now, under the direction of Megan Smith. Join me for Live and Local weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the second hour today, we'll go to the archives for a conversation that we had back in April with Sherry Turkle. She's a scholar at MIT who studies the impact of technology on society. We talked about her new book, her most recent book. It's titled Alone Together. And in that book, she makes the argument that as much as information technology has the capacity to bring people together, it can also give us the ability to hide from each other, even as we are constantly connected. So if you missed that first time around, You can hear that in the second hour today. Tomorrow, much of the program will be preempted because we want to bring you live coverage of a speech that President Obama will be giving. This is a speech that is being billed as a major statement on a change in focus for the United States and its policy in the Middle East. So that will be live, and we'll be bringing you that tomorrow morning. Let me also mention one more show for this week because it's one of the things we do every month. It's our monthly show on personal finance. David Sinnoh will be here. This is Friday in the 10 o'clock hour. He's a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business, and we'll take questions on personal finance and money management. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics each week. You can see the schedule, so if you're looking for programs that might interest you, or you can also go back and listen to past shows you might have missed. It's all on our website. That is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, our guest is Jenny Scott. She's been a newspaper reporter for more than 30 years, most recently at the New York Times. She was member of a team that wrote a series on race in America that won the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting in 2000. Back in 2007, early 2008, as part of the paper's coverage of the presidential campaign, she wrote a number of biographical articles about then-Senator Barack Obama. She wrote an article about his mother, which appeared in the paper and got her interested in finding out more about Ann Dunham, and that led to the book that we're talking about this morning. Again, the title is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. It's published by Riverhead Books. And questions, welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We were talking just a little bit ago about her meeting her second husband. It was an Indonesian man, and they went back to live in Indonesia. That marriage didn't last, but the connection with Indonesia certainly did. What about that place do you think she found so appealing, fascinating? What drew her?
Well, Indonesia is a very complex, interesting, multi-layered place. It's physically fantastically beautiful. She was in Java, which is an amazing landscape of volcanoes and rivers and spectacular, you know, green paddy field landscapes. And the villages are in many ways timeless. They have not been, and particularly hadn't been when she was there, sort of modernized. So you, as I think it's for anthropologists in particular, it's especially interesting because there's the persistence of traditional way of living, a traditional economy, traditional lines of work, small industries, handicraft industries, producing objects that are used in the daily life of all Javanese people. So there's that. But also, I think she, as I said, it's a complicated place culturally. It involves many layers of history and different influences, Hindu and Islamic and Chinese. I mean, there's everything is layered on top of each other, amazing temples going back. It's a very old culture. So as a complex place with enormous history and cultural variety, it's just fascinating in a way that I think many Americans haven't had a chance yet to experience. So I think many people who go to Indonesia find it captivating, and people who go when they're young, just as any place you go in your 20s, for some of those people, it becomes really their first home. I interviewed a lot of people who had gone there young, either as students or for work reasons, who really ended up feeling that it was their first home and staying for much of the rest of her life. She also, I think, got along very well with Indonesian people. She, in some ways, there were some Midwestern qualities she had that fit in very well there, a kind of modesty and self-restraint, and some of the values that she had grown up with were actually Javanese values. So many, many things, I think, happened to her. A, she went there with someone that she had fallen in love with and married. She then had the crucial period in her early life there, getting her career off the ground, doing her field work there. And then she discovered that because of her field work, which involved working in small villages and studying the lives of these people working in cottage industries, like making, doing pottery or baskets or blacksmithing work, working with iron. Because of that, she developed a skill that was useful in this burgeoning field of international development. So this was at a time when the United States Agency for International Development was actually hiring a lot of anthropologists to try and make development work better, because traditionally it had been these sort of huge projects that many of which were not supported after the agency left. There was a shift in the late 70s in which the agency began to work on sort of bottom-up development, where you really needed to understand the communities. And so a person like Ann Dunham was enormously valuable to agencies trying to do those projects. And so she got a lot of, she was able to get work doing that, which would enable her to continue her work toward her dissertation, but also to support her children and her family.
Yeah.
So I think she just became swept away by a lot of different aspects of that place.
And she, just to pick up on something you said, she had this long ambition of long standing to get this PhD in anthropology, which was really tough because of her obligations to her family. She finally did get it. I think it took her 20 years, but she finally did get it. And interestingly enough, her dissertation was on blacksmithing.
Yes, it was, and it was 1,043 pages long. She started off writing about five different village industries, and she wanted to show, explore the way these industries, which were really small things that people did out of their houses often and in their backyards, that they'd become a crucial way of supporting families, because during the Green Revolution and the agricultural advances, a lot of people could no longer work in the fields because it was much more efficient. And so a lot of women in particular ceased to work in agriculture and moved into these handicraft industries. And what her discovery was the enormous role that they played in alleviating poverty and keeping people out of poverty and supporting families. So that's what she was looking at. But she was so voracious, she studied, you know, wanted to study every industry. And so then she narrowed it down to five. And finally, when her drafts of her dissertation were coming in at hundreds and hundreds of pages, her dissertation advisor said, look, you've got to just settle on one. So she picked, interestingly, the one that was all male. Blacksmithing was a very respected profession in Java, and at that point was practiced entirely by men. So much of her research was in the backyard smithies and forges of these households, and where only the men in the families worked.
She marries this Indonesian man. They go back to Indonesia. She takes her son with him, and they live there, I think, for 6 years?
4 years.
Four years. Okay. And so, oh yeah, right, he was six. And it was, I'm trying to keep all this straight. So when he was 10, when Barack was 10, Anne made the decision to send him back to Hawaii to live with her parents so he could go to school. And I think the reason this is important is that there has been so much written about where the president lived and what sort of influences there were on him and what his sort of identification is. It seems pretty clear that as far as his mom was concerned, she wanted him to grow up and be educated in an American setting, an American context, and to go to a very fine school where the language was English. And then it seemed that in her mind, there was no doubt in her mind that her son was an American.
Yes, there was no doubt. She had taken him there for the reasons we discussed, and he had gone to schools that where the language was Indonesian, a Catholic school and then an Indonesian school where, you know, it's a Muslim country, so to the extent that the school had a religion, it was Islam. But these were basically, that was sort of a public school, and they were not taught, the classes were not taught in English, and she wanted him to have an English language education, and she particularly wanted him to have a very high caliber education because she wanted him to have the opportunities that she had had that came from going to a great university. And she realized that at 10, he'd gotten kind of what he was going to get out of the educational opportunities there, and it was time for him to go back and go to a really good school. There happened to be a really good school two blocks from his parents' apartment, and her parents' apartment. And so she sent him back to live with her parents and go to that school, Punahou. She apparently, this was a very difficult decision for her. She, you have to bear in mind, she was married to an Indonesian. She had a second child then who was, half Indonesian. So she couldn't just pick up and move herself. So what she did as a temporary measure was to send him back. She then joined him, and moved back there for a number of years while she went to graduate school and he was in middle school. And then when she got to the point where she had to do her field work if she wanted to get her PhD, she left him again with his parents for high school so that he could go to high school at Punahou. But yes, on your basic question, she had made it a decision that she wanted him to have the opportunities and experience that existed for an American child of his background, and she did not want him to be. She began to see that having him in Indonesia was going to deprive him of that.
Yeah, and it seems very clear. There's no question that she loved Barack very much, and that she believed from the point that he was just a tot, she believed that her son was going to achieve great things.
Many, many people told me that they could recall at different points in her life her saying, he's so bright, he's so brave, he could do anything. And some of them said that she said he could even be president. She had enormous confidence in his abilities. And she also worked very hard to shape his values to encourage him to move in the direction of some kind of public service. With both of her children, she always emphasized, along with hard work and empathy, that one's duty to other people and the importance of doing work that really made things better for other people, created greater opportunity for them. Both of her children say that that was sort of the constant message of their teaching in the area of values.
We have a caller here and would welcome others. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Jenny Scott. She's the author of a new biography of Barack Obama's mother. The title of her book is A Singular Woman. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Champaign County, here where we are. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I've heard you before, and one of the things that you haven't mentioned yet was the character of the Indonesian husband, how he was sort of, when he was at the East-West Center in Hawaii, he was happy-go-lucky. But I think, you know, you described the cataclysm in Indonesia, the bloodbath, a little bit. But he was actually impressed in the military service when he came back, wasn't he, if I recall correctly?
Yes, that's right. His arrangement, as I understand it from his relatives, was that he was sent abroad for his education, and in return he owed the government approximately 4 years of service. So he was called back, as I said, after the upheaval, and he was he joined the army, and he was sent to what is now Papua New Guinea to help in mapping of the border there. And so he was gone for a significant chunk of time, part of it when Anne was there. So you're right, he was under a lot of pressure when he returned to Indonesia. He had been able to be, as you pointed out, a happy-go-lucky, you know, a foreign student at the University of Hawaii in this very, you know, enjoyable, pleasant environment. And he found himself plunged back into a position of considerable political pressure, also cultural expectations and family expectations. So when he returned to Indonesia, he was in some ways a different person than the one Anne had known at the University of Hawaii.
I don't know if this is out in left field, but this cataclysm, bloodbath, was engineered by the CIA with Sukarno, and Agency International for Development was an asset of the CIA. I wonder whether she ever thought about it in that kind of context, or whether there was not the political. I mean, there's a possibility that she was thinking that, you know, she's trying to make up a bit for what she might have seen happen.
Well,
the country she fell in love with. I there's a lot there. There's a little time left. I have one little
question. Can I just respond to that?
Yeah, well, I was going to hang up after I say that. Can you talk about his first name, Barry?
Yeah, I do want to answer your point about the CIA.
Okay,
all right.
Who.
Yeah, let's get we'll do both those things.
I think that the from what I have read and the people that I've interviewed on this subject, exactly what happened in that coup and counter coup is not fully understood. And while the CIA clearly had an interest in Indonesia in terms of, or the Americans had an interest in Indonesia in terms of a concern that perhaps the Communist Party was becoming too powerful there, I don't think there's any clear evidence or there's any clear agreement on exactly what happened in that coup or who was behind it. And I've not ever seen it asserted that it's absolutely clear the CIA was involved. And as for USAID, you know, she was a subcontractor at one point in her career for an agency that did, you know, for an international development organization based in Bethesda. She was at a remove from USAID. If you're suggesting that she had, you know, some kind of CIA contact, I encountered absolutely no evidence of that.
All right. We have another caller here. We want to try to get them in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. There are two things that I may have missed because I was out of the house, but that I've thought about a long time with concerning the president. Why the media has just pounded away at the fact that he is a black man as though he did not have a mother. And the other thing, I think much of his intelligence has been attributed to the values or the work of his father. And if she got an early acceptance to the University of Chicago at the age of 17, she was an incredibly bright woman. And I just think that should be stressed more. Thank you.
All right. Well, again, that I guess that goes to the question of how and why in all the various ways his mom and her contribution to the person he turned out to be seems to have been downplayed or kind of brushed aside.
Well, I looked at that because I was interested in the characterization of her in his memoir. You have to remember that the memoir arose out of a moment when he had just been elected first black president of the Harvard Law Review, as it was described at the time. And there was a series of articles, profiles of him written in major newspapers at that time, in which if you go back and look at those articles, you can see the beginnings of his telling of his life story in exactly the way we came to hear it in 2004 at the Democratic Convention and then during the campaign in 2008. And I think the fact that he wrote that book prompted by an agent who contacted him and said, you know, you have such an interesting life story. She had seen these articles that had appeared after his election. You know, could you write that story? And it was focused around his search for his racial identity. And I think to be searching for your racial identity when you're half African and half white American in this culture at that time meant figuring out where you fit in racially. So I think for various reasons having to do with the timing of that book and all, and the telling of the story came to be more about the father than the mother. And, you know, maybe that's also in the details that the media glommed onto. I don't know whether the way he was telling it to those reporters was exactly the way it came out, or that what interested them also was the Kenyan father, the former goat herd, rather than the white woman from Wichita.
Well, and you know, Mr. Obama himself could have chosen to emphasize both sides of his heritage, but he decided to identify himself as black. How did she feel about that?
There are some interesting conversations I had, which are in the book, with people who, particularly one person who worked very closely with her during the period that her son was beginning to immerse himself in Chicago politics and get interested in running for office. And this person, who was very friendly with her, and they worked closely together, and they also lived in the same house with a bunch of other people during that period, said that she had a certain feeling of what he described as wistfulness about this, a sense that, and this is his language, quoting Anne or paraphrasing Anne, that she felt that he had made, that her son had made a, quote, professional choice to self-identify and to emphasize the black side of himself, and that was a choice that was unfamiliar to her because she felt it had not really been a part of his childhood, and that she had this feeling, as the man described to me, not of rejection, but a sense that he was putting distance between himself and her. I don't know. You know, that's one person's testimony, and it does seem that she had a recurrent feeling in her life of wanting a closer relationship with him. But that's the only thing I can really tell you that sheds light on that particular question.
Yeah. Very short on time. We have one more caller I'm trying to get here in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just want to reinforce the notion that that Indonesian society in the 60s in that period was intellectually very exciting. I moved in those same circles. I'm an anthropologist. I was a fellow in the East-West Center in 1963. I worked as a consultant for the Ford Foundation in Indonesia. I spoke Indonesian. I did research there. I trained anthropologists there. And I know that culture of that period, and indeed it was a wonderfully exciting intellectually and culturally. So I just want to emphasize that. Thank you.
All right. I don't know, Ms. Scott, if you want to say anything more in response to that.
Yeah, I'd be curious if you ever encountered her.
We've gone. Well, we're down to the point here. We essentially have about a minute left, and I guess maybe I want to come back to what is naturally here a central kind of question that I just brushed up against when I was introducing the show, and that is this question of the ways in which his mom and her character and her experiences and her way of looking at the world helped to shape and make the man that Barack Obama became.
Two ways, I would say. I mean, many ways, but I'll sum them up in two. Her values are deeply imprinted upon him, and he makes it very clear that his decision to go into public life came from her and that notion that the greatest good one can do and the most important thing one can do with one's life is to work for opportunity for other people. I think that's very clearly came from her, and this sense that you can reach across a vast divide and make contact with people who seem very different. On the other hand, he made it clear to me when I interviewed him last summer that he chose not to live the way she chose to live. He didn't, while he understood the attraction of the expatriate life and the global citizen's life, he wanted a kind of rootedness that he didn't experience as a child and that he craved. So he said he made a conscious decision to not embrace that life, but instead root himself in Chicago, marry a woman from Chicago, and create as a primary value in his life stability for his children of a sort that he hadn't had.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating story, and I certainly will recommend it to folks. The book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. It is published by Riverhead Books. It's just recently come out. And the author, our guest, Jenny Scott, she was a newspaper reporter for more than 30 years, most recently at the New York Times. And Ms. Scott, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. It was nice to be here.